Hey y'all, thanks for joining us for this edition of the Rose Chat Podcast. On this episode, Mike Shoup, author and creator of the Antique Rose Emporium, takes us on a creative journey with roses, giving us their history and all the ways they complement the garden. Y'all stay with us. The Rose Chat Podcast starts now.
It's time for the Rose Chat Podcast, a podcast dedicated to celebrating the world's most beloved flower, the rose. Join award-winning gardeners Chris Van Cleef and Teresa Byington as they chat with rose lovers and experts from around the globe. With each episode, you'll gain valuable knowledge and insights to achieve the rose garden you've always dreamed of. Listen now as we explore the world of roses.
Try Haven Brand Soil Conditioners, providing generations of gardeners with a truly all-natural alternative to chemical fertilizers with their line of composted manure and alfalfa teas. Easy to brew and use on all indoor and outdoor plants. Find them online at manuretea.com.
Hey, Mike, welcome to Rose Chat.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be a part of this.
Well, we're so glad to have you. You know, Mike, you have such a rich history with roses. I mean, who has more? And I'm just wondering, how did you come to fall in love with them so much?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting story, and it's not all as straight lined as you might think. I actually love gardening, and knew early on that I would be involved with growing plants or having something to do with gardening or landscaping. And with that, I got a degree in horticulture at Texas A&M, and went ahead and got my master's there. With the idea of growing plants and being in the horticulture industry. But interesting enough, you know, I did not want to have anything to do with the rose. I had my prejudice and bias, like a lot of people did at that time period, with roses. Roses were wonderful and beautiful, but they had a reputation of being fussy and kind of hard to grow and petulant and all the different things that are associated with some of the things with roses. You know, they can be troublesome and with heavy work ethic kind of standards that go along with them. And I was one of these types that wanted something that was easy, that was actually part of the landscape, part of the garden that you didn't fuss over. So roses were out of my vocabulary. And so something happened along the way that made me completely change. And that's kind of what the story's about. I was growing native plants and plants for the landscape industry when I started a little nursery back in the 1980s and, actually 1970s. Gosh, it's been a long time now. And was very successful for a little while until the economy went south here in Texas, the early 80s. The economy was in a recession, and we were struggling. I couldn't compete with the larger companies that were growing plants and had a difficulty surviving. And it was in that struggle that I found roses. Interesting enough, I was growing a lot of native Texas plants as alternatives to the ordinary exotic plants like ligustrum and Asiatic jasmine and, you know, those types of plants that filled up the landscape, but wasn't able to compete in a time in a recession with those things because they were a dime a dozen and I was left holding the bag and banks were calling my notes and I went into deep depression. But just combing out the countryside, hunting for native plants was a wonderful way of bringing something that was unique to the landscape. But it was difficult too to make a living because people and my customers were not, you know, were not knowledgeable about native plants. They didn't know what to expect. So it was still a hard sell for me. But interesting enough, I found roses growing in the exact locations that native plants evolved in. And this was like, what? You know, how can roses, these fussy plants that need lots of human care to survive, be growing out where plants evolved without any human care at all? And so this was like an abandoned home sites, old fence rows, cemeteries. And so this is when it all started. I started bringing back a few of these plants by taking cuttings from these roses. They flourished in the same environment that my other plants were that I was growing grew. And I said, I need to take a second look at these things. So therein born the love of roses, because all of a sudden I realized I had a plant that was time tested, you know, easy to grow, a survivor. And not only that, it had qualities that I had no idea were as good for the landscape as these roses provided. And those two qualities are really, in a nutshell, there are two, and that is fragrance. And fragrance to me is the soul of the plant. It's the memory. It's the emotion. It's everything about what makes these roses so charming to me. And it's because they indeed strike a chord in people. When people smell roses, it takes them back into time or helps create a memory. In my way of thinking, fragrance is so, you know, is so important. I mean, if you hold up a rose and you smell it and it doesn't have any fragrance, you might as well be looking at a pretty rose in a book. You know, it doesn't tie you to the flower. But when it has a fragrance, it indeed has that wonderful memory or emotion that's associated with it. And it's such a tragedy that we don't have, you know, most of our modern roses were bred without the idea of bringing fragrance into them. So that was one thing that really, you know, took me back to these roses and said, these are worth growing. And number two was, of course, they're easy to grow. If you're finding them growing in cemeteries where dead people can grow them, you know, then anybody can grow them. So it was that we started collecting these roses. We didn't know what the names of them were, but we were amassing great numbers of these roses that we were finding out in the outback of Texas and beyond, and they were just flourishing in our garden. So we started the Rose Emporium based on the fact that we were going to offer time-tested surviving roses that had this wonderful fragrance and kind of bring them back into the industry. And that's truly what it was. We weren't finding new plants. We were finding plants that were introduced many, many years ago as the cultivated varieties that our pioneers, you know, once adored. And they had been not grown for the last 50 or 100 years and lost in commerce. So we didn't know what the names of these roses are, even though they survived in these places for many, many years. And so as we consulted old literature and catalogs, we were able to actually identify that a lot of these roses came from the 1800s and were introduced into some of historical threads. I know one rose we found was called Louis Philippe, and it was a rose that was introduced by Lorenzo de Zavala, who was a minister to France when Texas was a republic. And so it was a gift to him from the French, and he established it in his home in Lynchburg, Texas, and it has been disseminated throughout Texas since then. It was roses that we found like this that were, you know, still growing in cemeteries and in some of these homes that we were finding. And those stories too, I just keep getting excited about this, because we would find individual, usually in the less affluent neighborhoods that dot, you know, any of your communities or states, there's places that aren't able to keep up with the horticultural trends and go out and buy new plants. They mm-hmm. share them in the neighborhood. And so we'd find roses growing and dotted in these neighborhoods, and it would be the same rose. And it was a rose that was unidentifiable. And you'd go up to the door and you knock on the door, and they would say, you know, oh, yeah, we've had this rose for a long time. Somebody over there shared cuttings with us, and it just grows and we love it. And well, it turned out to be a rose called Archduke Charles, introduced back into mm-hmm. the 1840s, or even better, Cremoisia Superior, or any of these old roses that we were finding. So there was a historical thread, there was a fragrance thread, there were this time-tested, tough varieties, and beyond that, they were also diverse in their form. And that, to me, is the magic of these plants, because all of them are different in their architecture and the way they bloom and the way they flourish. And so you can't plant a rose garden with these plants. It wouldn't work because they're all different. One will sprawl, one will be upright, one will, you know, be small leafed. I mean, they're all totally different. But that's the genius of these plants, because it makes artists out of gardeners. Because it's like individual brushstrokes for your garden masterpiece, each one of them different. And so as you use these roses in the landscape, you're able to bring out your creativity. They don't belong in a rose garden. They belong with other plants. They belong to embellish the architecture of your fence or your home or your driveway. All of them different. All the companions that you put with them would be different, and all are very, very personal and creative. And so that, in my mind, really is the spirit of gardening, and that's what roses bring out. So from me not wanting to grow roses at all, I completely became overboard in my love and being a fan of these roses, and they were totally different than what I had associated roses of being. And it was only finding the qualities in the old rose that brought me forth, you know, into this realm of understanding how wonderful they are.
Well, when you say history and fragrance, and then you begin to tell the story, and they're already so beautiful. We see that first up. They're just so enchanting. And all the things that you were saying about in the landscape reminds me of one of my favorite books. And I have a lot of rose books, and a lot of my rose books are about old garden roses. But Landscaping with Antique Roses is one of your books. And so for our listeners who are interested in some of adding to their own gardens and actually landscaping with these old roses, I would highly recommend that book, because it gives you so many ideas and you see all these beautiful ways that they're used.
Well, thank you. Yes. And we have a tagline here at the nursery, and we say, we don't have rose gardens. We have gardens that have roses in them. And to me, that encapsulates what we're all about. You know, the roses have gone through this renaissance over the years, where they were once used in the breeders trying to perfect the rose and getting that nice high center, bright colors, long, strong stems. And they achieved that, but they achieved it to the detriment of what was a great garden plant in the old rose. And so what we have done is simply gone back and cherished our selected roses as they once were, and found that they're great, great garden plants, and they ebb and flow in the seasons with all the other plants that are around them, and as a result they contribute so much, and there's not so much of a onus on them to be perfect all the time. They ebb and flow just like any plant would. And if you have them in combination with other plants, well, then the burden is not on them to be perfect all the time. And I think that that's a great joy to people who have found that old roses are easy to grow, and then they cherish the times when they are perfect and they are in bloom and they have that wonderful fragrance. And then the times when they're resting, they can enjoy the rest of the garden that is also contributing at that time. So that's the way we enjoy our roses, is to have them planted, you know, in a garden setting, in a very diverse garden setting, and where one can be creative. I often joke that if I was to give, you know, five sets of plants to an individual and have you go out and plant them, that each one would be different, the way you would mix the colors of the hardscape that you choose. And therein lies the beauty of gardening. It's different, it's unique, and it's infinite. And that's what makes everything so beautiful, is to see how people, you know, express themselves with these plants. So roses, they just are what I call the ultimate garden plant. They give you so much opportunity to do so much in the garden. And with the diversity of form and fragrance, and all the different colors you get, they're just truly spectacular.
I would totally agree. So now tell us a little bit about the Texas Rose Rustlers.
Well, the Texas Rose Rustlers was a loosely organized group back in the late 70s, when I was struggling and became involved with trying to find my niche. this was a group of people that I became involved with that were already going out and hunting for roses that were lost and forgotten in these places like cemeteries and older communities. And because of my association with them, Joe Woodard and Pam Purier and Dr. William Welch, all these individuals who were some of the early characters, if you will, of this rose rustling saga, I too collected a lot of the roses that we shared with each other. So not only would we go out in groups sometimes, which could be intimidating to anybody coming up that had a rose in their yard, but individually we would go out and we'd find different plants, and then we'd meet together socially. Pam used to make cucumber sandwiches, and we'd eat those, and we'd talk about the roses that we discovered. And this is how the Rose Emporium started, is through sharing, is through collecting a lot of these roses through all these individuals whose finds were just so fascinating. And I started growing each one of them and offering them in the spirit that these were truly time-tested, easy-to-grow plants. Very, very different than the modern rose that was being sold at the time.
Well, I'm thinking when I hear that all rose lovers have a bit of a rustler in them. So what advice would you give to our listeners on rustling roses?
Well, there is an etiquette, of course. And roses are true survivors. And what I have learned that there are many, many roses still out there. We're getting calls from individuals who say that their grandmother has passed away and she had a rose at their house and they don't want to lose a rose. And can we identify it? And in many cases, we can't identify it. We don't know what it is. So that means quite possibly this rose is a throwback to time that is still surviving on its own. And it may be, you know, one of a very few survivors of its type. And so this is what is so nice. The other thing is there are many roses that we come across in places, in cemeteries, in older neighborhoods, and it's important that these roses be saved and be brought forth. They've already proved themselves of being survivors and have that worth all by themselves. So, you know, the etiquette involved is simply this. We want those roses to survive into the future for as many years as they have survived in the past. And in order to do that, we would never dig them up. And you would only try to protect them in the manner of grooming out any weed seeds. In many cases, trees have been planted by the mockingbird that might be sitting in them, planting a hackberry, as you would in here in Texas, and then the hackberry would eventually shade that rose and kill it. So we cut those trees out, or we cut the weeds out, give that rose an opportunity to live into the future. If it is healthy enough, we'll take a cutting, and that cutting could be the future of that rose because it is a clone of that one variety. And if that variety happens to die, well, then you have the genetic material, you have that exact rose to pass forward. So the idea of rose rustling is not pillaging or of digging roses. It is really of saving them, making sure that that there are roses in the future from these time-tested survivors. And so that is essentially what we have done. And I've been very, very fortunate in order to be able to offer a lot of these roses still without names. In many cases, we're not able to determine what the name of the rose was that we found because the literature is too foggy or not descriptive enough to tell if you've got that particular rose that was introduced back in the 1850s or 60s. But that doesn't diminish its value. It's still here in our current time, and I think that gives it its value. And so that's kind of the spirit of rose rustling, I think.
Well, as you were talking about that, even though you don't know the true name, it now has a rich story, where it was found, who found it, how it was taken care of. That becomes its story. So that's beautiful in itself.
Well, it is. And there have been so many stories. The story I mentioned about Louis Philippe and Cremoisy Superior from Lorenzo de Zavala, You've got the current stories of Peggy Martin with the Hurricane Katrina surviving Rose. And so, you know, these stories are a wonderful part of the tapestry of the history of these roses. And I think that that in itself is the added thread that you know, that ties a lot of interest to this. We had, you know, Tom Christopher write that wonderful book on the rose. I'm sorry, I forget the name of it now, but it's about the rose rustling saga in Texas. And it was so easy to read. It was a wonderful book. But there's a lot of history and there's a lot of stories that come of growing these roses.
If I'm not mistaken, I think the name of that book is In Search of Lost Roses.
That's it. It would make sense, wouldn't it?
So simple, it's difficult.
That's right.
Yeah, that happens. Next, could you give our listeners two or three top tips for growing this type of rose?
Yes. I'm a believer in Mother Nature's ways, and so I try to replicate those. And I really believe in the living soil. And so a lot of what we preach is making sure that in growing any plants, including these roses, to provide the food for microbial life. And that is compost. It's the bark mulches. When we take any existing soil that we have and embellish them with this organic matter we call compost, and then later we mulch these roses, we have provided, you know, really almost the perfect template for them to survive. And they don't need the rich fertilizers. We don't see people out in the forest fertilizing the forest or the prairies. So Mother Nature has her ways to recycle the leaf litter and the barks into food for the microbial life in the soil that then preserves the integrity of life with our higher life forms of plants by providing fertility, by providing, you know, moisture control and air control, and disease pressures are eliminated. It's just a total package, and it's arrogant for us to assume that we can do it with our synthetic fertilizers and stuff. So that is number one, is to make sure of that. Number two is to select roses that are truly time-tested and that can, you know, that can grow in your particular microclimate, if you will. My particular situation here in Central Texas is not the same as it would be, you know, up in Minnesota or in Colorado or any place like that. So the template, the genetics of roses are such that they are equipped to grow better in certain places. So choice of what you grow is extremely important as well. And so if you struggle with a particular rose, well, then it's probably because that rose is not happy in that particular environment. But believe me, there are many that would be. And choosing the right one makes life a whole lot better for you. And not only you'll be happy, but the rose would be happy too. So that's number two is making sure that your selection is good. And so that's, you know, that's kind of what we teach. Another particular tip that I get all the time is that people are somewhat afraid to manipulate or to deal with their roses. And roses are like clay. They love to be manipulated and trained and pruned and shaped. And indeed, those rules that I was so afraid of with the original hybrid tea roses, they're very few and far between with the old roses because they're true landscape plants. All you're trying to do is fit them so that they fit into the scale of the garden that they reside in. So pruning takes on a whole different measure. We're not going down there and cutting each rose back a third, you know, on the eighth day of February or whatever those rules are. We're simply shearing these roses, shaping them so that they look good within the context of the roses of the landscape that they reside in. So in other words, we can have the same variety of rose be in one garden and be in another garden, and both of them being pruned and shaped differently. And that's not, that's what's good about it, is the fact that you're treating the rose so that it belongs in the garden that it resides in, not by certain rules that, that have been formulated to cut them back with, you know, a certain stringency of 1/3 and certain timing and stuff like that. The other is the climbing rose saga. Climbing roses are, to me, one of the most romantic and dramatic aspects of gardening. They are the ooh and ah of your landscape. And climbers are just simply spectacular, but they are 95% of your work in your garden. And by that, I mean you can have 100 shrub roses and one climber, and still in your yard with that, that particular ratio of plants, you need to spend 95% of your gardening effort on the climber. But if you do, you would have the ooh and ah of your garden, you know, going forward, because climbers are challenging. And when you buy a structure, whether it be a trellis or an arbor, you know, a pergola, you want that climbing rose to be tidy. So you're attaching every available cane and making it very, very neat, very perfect. And there are many canes that will not cooperate, and those just simply be cut off. You prune them away because you do not want chaos. You want that structure that you get spent good money on to be embellished perfectly by the climbing rose. So you have to be diligent. You have to work hard. You have to get on a ladder. It is hard work, and it takes a lot of time. But if you do, it is the most wonderful aspect of your garden. When it is in bloom, you have all your neighbors over, you have parties, you do all the stuff because it is so spectacular. Often say that, you know, you can prune your shrub roses and all your neighbors will come over and take pictures. But when you prune and train a climbing rose properly, when it goes into bloom, you have Southern Living or Better Homes and Gardens coming over and taking pictures. Because they are the ooh and ah of your landscape, and they are the most important thing to deal most of your time and effort on, because they create such a moving and dramatic part of the expression in your garden.
That is so.
So those are some of my tips.
Oh, and those are so such not only good tips, but the way you describe them, it just, you know, takes you right to the swoon zone. So, and it's true. A climber done right, there is just nothing like it.
That's right. And they are very, very important ingredients in our garden. And yet 99% of them are abused and not properly utilized. We have more phone calls about people calling us saying, well, I planted this rose on the structure and it's keeping me from getting into the house now, you know? And so... It's a matter of discipline, and most people are afraid to touch their roses, but roses love to be manipulated, and the more you mess with them, the more they give you back. It's like the little prince, the story of the little prince. It's like it's the time that you have wasted on your rose that gives them all their value, and that's essentially what was that came out of that book that I love to use now that I'm involved with roses the way I am.
So true.
But anyway, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
So true. Okay, now we've made all of our listeners fall in love with these roses and, of course, the fragrance. So in our final minutes, could you share 1, 2, maybe even 3 roses that, if we're going for fragrance, that you would recommend?
Oh, wow. Well, I have to go with Belinda's Dream. Belinda's Dream has wonderful fragrance, but to me, it is the transition rose. In other words, it has become so popular in our industry because, to me, it crosses over between all the qualities of an old rose and yet still maintaining some of the qualities of the modern roses. It holds its head up high. It's a good cut flower. It's a compact bush that's relatively disease-free. And it has wonderful fragrance. So not only does it look like a modern rose, but it behaves like an old rose, is tough in the garden, and has this wonderful fragrance. So I just feel like you're going to have a win-win with it, no matter who it goes to, when you get Belinda's Dream. And we have a sport of that rose called Belinda's Blush that's more of a light white apricot color. And it's just, you know, since it's a sport, it's the same behavior, same fragrance, and all of that. So it's also a wonderful rose. But other than that, gosh, I love Sombrel as a mannerly climber. It comes out with a flat flower, but the petals are so numerous and they're so perfectly formed and so perfectly imbricated over each other. They look like feathers on a dove's neck, you know, and the way they open, and they are extremely fragrant. So Sombrel is another one that just brings out the romantic quality of roses in its shape and form. And then when you smell it, you know, it's just kind of like, oh, you know, you've got to have it around you all the time. So there's some examples right there that you've got me on. And of course, if you ask me tomorrow, I'll give you two more. It's just always the way it is. There's fragrances is prominent in a lot of these roses, and it's just a matter which one you decide to pick on that day. So they're really nice.
I can say the same. I have three Belinda's Dream, and they are absolutely wonderful in all the ways that you said. And you're growing in Texas, and I'm growing in Indiana, and they're just as beautiful,
exactly.
Just as fragrant, just exactly. As healthy here. So wouldn't be without that one. It's definitely a winner. Would highly recommend. And I just thank you so much for joining us today and sharing not only your fascinating story, but the stories of these roses. They are fascinating. And I'm just so glad to know that they're in such good hands at the Antique Rose Emporium.
Oh, thank you, Teresa. It's been great. Love visiting with you and sharing the passion.
Well, Rose friends, we hope you've enjoyed today's program and are already looking for a place to plant at least one of these fragrant historical beauties. And until next time, happy gardening from your friends at Rose Chat.
You've been listening to the Rose Chat Podcast with Chris Van Cleve and Teresa Byington, expert rose gardeners who want to help you achieve the rose garden of your dreams. Don't miss an episode. Listen anytime on our website at rosechatpodcast.com or listen on the go via the Rose Chat app on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Share this podcast with your social networks and join us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by using the hashtag RoseChat. Join us next time for another edition of the Rose Chat Podcast. The Rose Chat Podcast is a production of the Rose Chat Media Group, Birmingham, Alabama.